Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. President Bush surprised world leaders at the annual G8 summit last week when he closed a meeting with "Goodbye from the world's biggest polluter." In the wake of Bush's joke, Al Gore delivered a speech yesterday in Washington insisting America should wean itself off of carbon-based fuels by 2018 or face the consequences.
There are times in the history of our nation when our very way of life depends upon dispelling illusions and awakening to the challenge of a present danger. This is such a moment. The survival of the United States of America as we know it is at risk.
Gore also says his plan would boost our sluggish economy and save the auto industry. For more on the speech and its reception, we've got Andrew C. Revkin. He covers the environment for the New York Times and the paper's .earth blog. And Joseph Rome is a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. He also ran the Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy at the Department of Energy in the 1990s. Andrew Revkin and Joseph Rome, welcome to WNYC.
Good to be with you.
First, let's hear a bit from Al Gore's speech yesterday. Here's some more.
So today, I challenge our nation to commit to producing 100% of our electricity from renewable energy and truly clean carbon-free sources within 10 years. This goal is achievable, affordable, and transformative. It represents a challenge to all Americans in every walk of life, to our political leaders, entrepreneurs, innovators, engineers, and to every citizen. A few short years ago, it would not have been possible to issue such a challenge. But here's what's changed. The sharp cost reductions now beginning to take place in solar, wind, and geothermal power, coupled with the recent dramatic price increases for oil and coal, have radically changed the economics of energy.
So 100% clean energy in 10 years. This deadline is a shift for Gore, who in the past has not announced any kind of timetable. Achievable, affordable, and transformative? Well, transformative, to be sure. Andrew Revkin, what do you think? Achievable?
Well, I don't know. If he was on a truth meter or something, I think you'd have to go to what my colleague John Broder wrote in the paper today, where Gore said to Broder, "I see my role as enlarging the political space in which Senator Obama and Senator McCain can confront the issue as president next year." In other words, I think he knows he's overreaching.
Huh. And this is just an opportunity to get everybody to talk about this.
Yeah, it certainly gets attention. There is a danger here, and I think both Joe Rahm and I have written about this before on our blogs, that I mean, there's this fine line between overreaching to create political space and looking like you're just not being you're entirely unrealistic.
Joseph Rome, where do you think Al Gore stands in this? Unrealistic or you encouraging an aggressive debate?
Well, I think it's important to change the terms of the debate because right now it's stuck on things like offshore drilling that would have no impact whatsoever on America's energy bill and obviously would just increase pollution. So I think the discussion needs to be framed in terms of we do have a path to get off of oil to stop the destruction of the planet's climate, and it involves a rapid switch to renewable electricity and then cars that run on that electricity, and that was his main point. Yeah, I do think that his bottom line goal was too aggressive, but you know, we're now seeing a lot of people from T. Boone Pickens to Intel's Andy Grove talk about the need for a very aggressive policy to switch to clean energy. And so I think that debate is very important to start.
Let's talk about that timetable, that aggressive timetable, the 2018 18 deadline, clearly, as you heard in the clip, was met with enthusiasm from this audience, which was a young audience. But do you think people respond to timetables anymore? Are they getting discouraged by them? Of course, we've talked about timetables for at least the past 4 years when it comes to Iraq. Andrew Revkin, the usefulness of a timetable with this?
Well, I think the other point he's making, which is an important one, and this is completely left out of the Group of Eight meetings, is that setting aspirational goals for 2050 is basically meaningless. So let's see what we can do in political cycles that are relevant, meaning, you know, 4, 6, 8, 10 years. Mm-hmm. But then if you're going to do that, and I'm sure, you know, well, one would hope that Gore will now start to articulate how, you know, what the actual ABC is for getting there. And it really is, we're talking about a lot of money, a lot of investment. You know, the idea of the national grid being juiced up in the way we did the national highway system is nice to touch on, but where's the money going to come from, and how do you build the political force to do that? One of the big dangers in this balance of trying to sustain energy security and climate stability is that energy security is here now, and for most people, climate security, climate stability is still a someday, somewhere issue. In fact, the main science still points to the worst impacts being down the line. So if you just focus on the energy problem, and unfortunately, humans don't have a good history of thinking in a multidisciplinary way, you end up turning coal into liquids like China is preparing to do on a large scale, and some people here want to do on a large scale, and that makes the climate problem ever bigger. So that's the issue. How do you actually meaningfully mesh the here and now energy security problem with the there and then climate problem?
I'm speaking with Andrew C. Revkin, who covers the environment for the New York Times and wrote about former Vice President Al Gore's speech in today's paper, and with Dr. Joseph Rome, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former director of the Department of Energy, Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in the 1990s. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. Andrew, you have a piece out. Your piece annotates Gore's speech. What are some of the criticisms you have of it?
Well, you know, again, I don't want to be nitpicky too much. Some people on the blog said, well, you're just kind of nitpicking in truthing it. But, and I've done the same thing on the blog with climate speeches by Gore, President Bush, McCain, and the Group of Eight folks. So it's just equal opportunity nitpicking. But the reality is, though, you know, if you're going to frame an argument that's going to gain political force, you do really have to pay attention to what's real. And Gore kind of did some things that were, he's been, criticized for, even among the scientific community sometimes, sliding into the, boy, we've had some strange weather lately, and not directly connecting the dots, but doing things in ways, talking about tornadoes, where the science is still very complicated in terms of a climate link, and touching on points where it's really not productive, potentially, in the long run.
A plan to cap greenhouse gas emissions in the U.S. was dropped in June. Joseph Rome, what has changed since then that would allow Al Gore's vision to come true in the next 10 years?
Well, people can read more on my blog, climateprogress.org. I think people have come to the view that high oil prices are not a short-term phenomenon, and that we are, in fact, at or near peak oil in terms of, you know, demand is outracing supply. So given that the United States has about 2% of the world's reserves and 25% of the demand, we're not going to drill our way out of this. Even oilman Pickens says that. So, and as I've written pretty extensively, there is only one alternative fuel that can substantially reduce Americans' energy fuel bills and the threat posed by foreign oil, and that is electricity. And the good news is that General Motors and Toyota and Volkswagen have committed in the next 2 years to deliver these plug-in hybrids that run on gasoline and can be plugged into the electric grid. So that is the vision. I think that more and more people realize that we need a substantial effort to get off of oil. And, you know, Gore set a 10-year timeline because that was, you know, when Kennedy launched the his commitment to put a man on the moon, which Gore referenced, that was, you know, by the end of this decade type of commitment. But, you know, I don't think that the specific details of the timetable are as important as the acknowledgement that, as he said, we do now have the clean energy technologies that are cost-effective. I mean, electricity prices have soared for all forms of traditional electricity, including coal and nuclear. So right now, wind and photovoltaics and concentrated solar thermal electric are all very competitive, and a major government push could really transform the electric grid, and then we need to transform the transportation system. And it's not, I mean, it will happen by itself, but only, you know, if we wait until oil gets to $6, $7, $8 a gallon, and Americans go through a great deal of pain. So either either we do it proactively or it isn't forced upon us.
Gore actually, in his speech, responded to critics who are skeptical of the high costs of alternative energy. Let's hear a little bit from it, and then I'll come back to you both and ask for your thoughts.
To those who say the costs are still too high, I ask them to consider whether the cost of oil and coal will ever stop increasing if we keep relying on quickly depleting energy sources to feed a rapidly growing demand all around the world. When demand for oil and coal increases, their price goes up. When demand for solar cells increases, the price often comes down. That's the difference. One source of fuel is expensive and going up, and the other source of fuel is free forever. When we send money to foreign countries to buy nearly 70% of the oil we use every day, they build new skyscrapers and we lose jobs. When we spend that money building solar arrays and windmills here, we build competitive industries and gain jobs here at home.
So where does what's the likely? There's been such debate, though, on converting to solar, wind, geothermal energy, and clean coal. Joseph Rome, do you think this argument is a compelling argument for Americans and more specifically for lawmakers, that they'll follow Gore's logic and say, let's invest in this now in the next 10 years?
Well, this is pretty easy to answer. It depends who's elected president. I think it's very clear that John McCain is not a big believer in these government-led technology efforts, and he has voted against most efforts to increase renewable energy standards and renewable energy subsidies. On the other hand, you know, Barack Obama has been very clear that he wants an aggressive renewable energy standard. He wants to spend a great deal of money promoting clean energy technologies. I'm not saying either one of them would hit Al Gore's goal, but you know, if you really want the transition to a clean energy economy and get away from this mindset of a gas tax holiday or a little more drilling offshore and feeding our addiction, there is a pretty clear choice in the presidential campaign, and that will determine what happens over the next decade.
And Andrew,
well, to some extent, Congress is still. I wrote something about this recently. Congress is the real barrier here, and I think Joe has too written about the power of these incumbent embedded interests in Washington. It was not a Republican but a Democrat, who Jesse Ossebel, one of the people I go to a lot for energy history technology input at Rockefeller University, he named the single person on Earth he thinks is responsible for the most greenhouse gas emissions in history is Robert Byrd, a Democrat from West Virginia, because of all the favors that have been done for big coal over the decades. So it's Congress has, and this gets to those young people who are in that room, and I've written about this too, that, you know, they have to get engaged in the political process, and they are. I think if you really want to sort of see this energy quest gain some traction.
I'm speaking with Andrew C. Revkin, who covers the environment for the New York Times, and Dr. Joseph Rome. He's the senior fellow at the Center for American Progress and former director of the Department of Energy, Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy in the 1990s. We will have more after a break. This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Amy Eddings, sitting in for Brian Lehrer, and we are talking about former Vice President Al Gore's speech calling on the nation in the next 10 years to move to 100% clean energy. And as Andrew C. Revkin, one of our guests, an environmental reporter for the New York Times, points out, that kind of challenge is fraught with technological and political challenges. Let's talk about some of the political challenges. On Capitol Hill, a compromise over offshore drilling is in the works. Democratic Senator Harry Reid is at the front of the effort to find a compromise between lifting the ban and increasing oil production at home. Is this the kind of baby step we need to achieve energy independence, or do we need a full-on change in mindset, which is what Gore is calling for? Andrew?
Well, you know, as Joe said, and as Gore said, we have very small resources in this country in terms of liquid fossil fuels in the ground, and they're not going to be anywhere near sufficient in the long haul to avoid the need for transformation. Fossil fuels are implicitly fossil. They were created long ago. There's like two scientists who think they're still being generated deep in the earth. And so we have to move on. Lauren Isley, in 1954, wrote this wonderful essay that I've quoted on Dot Earth a couple of times about the heat ladder. We've been climbing up the heat ladder through our progress as a species the last couple of hundred years. And the problem is we're stuck on the coal and oil rungs on that ladder. And, you know, we're sort of seduced by these 100 and 200-year-old fuels because they're sort of here now. But boy, oh boy, even Thomas Edison, in 1931, the year of his death, said, you know, the sun is the ultimate source of power. I hope we don't have to burn up all the coal and oil before we figure that out. He said that in 1931. So the need, there's logic to moving forward. It's all about speed. How fast? How much do you invest in the short run to make this transition to something new and renewable?
And just yesterday, we had the Federal Environmental Protection Agency announcing that climate change will pose substantial threats on human health in the next few years. This after it decided recently not to federally regulate greenhouse gases. Dr. Joseph Rome, how effective is the EPA as an organization if it's contradicting itself in this way?
Well, you know, look, there's a tension between the actual, you know, I will say hardworking civil servants who are driven by the facts, and I think the rather increasingly grim reality that if you don't take action on greenhouse gas emissions, the impacts are going to be serious. And the political appointees who I mean, I think Stephen Johnson and the political establishment of the EPA will go down as the worst of all time. And they, I mean, you have a situation where the White House isn't even reading emails sent to it by the EPA, but forcing them to take it back. I mean, we literally have a situation where the White House is forcing scientists and civil servants to, you know, not say what everybody knows to be the truth. So, I mean, the good news is it's only going to last a few more months, and I don't want to say it can't get any worse, but it is almost over.
It seems to me, though, that this gets into a philosophical question of where the impetus should come from. Al Gore is pointing out that these renewable energy sources are becoming cheaper. The time seems to be right to talk about them because of the rising cost of gasoline and this recognition that the prices aren't going to go down, that those low numbers were unrealistic in the past. So is this something that, you know, as laissez-faire, hands-off economists would propose, something that the market will figure out for itself, or does the initiative need to come from the government? For example, like from Texas, the Texas Public Utility Commission recently approved a $4.9 billion plan for wind energy projects. Texas, oil country, right? Is it possible to meet Gore's timetable without the financial support of White House organizations like the EPA? Should the market take control of this? Will it?
Well, Andy here, the market will not do, quote-unquote, the right thing for climate, for sure, if it's just up to the market, because for the most part, the long-term costs of coming from climate change are still not integrated into the market, how we price things. And that's the reality. So if we just focused on the long-term, on the near-term, immediate-term energy insecurity issue, You'll see a lot more emissions of CO2, carbon dioxide, coming down the pike, not just here, but everywhere. And again, I was just at a meeting that I wrote about recently, the Council on Foreign Relations, with some of the top people in China in the government scientific bureaucracy, saying they're building their big coal-to-gasoline plants right now. They're starting now. So it's that's where the power and the sort of the responsibility of leadership comes in.
And Joseph, Rome, 30 seconds, your two cents on this philosophical debate.
Well, ultimately, most of the money is going to come from the private sector. The market and the incentive system just has to be set right. Obviously, carbon dioxide, greenhouse gas emissions, cause major environmental harm, and there is no cost, there's no penalty. So until we put in a cap-and-trade system of setting a price for carbon, it's going to be very hard to get the market to do the right thing.
That's Joseph Rome, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress. And I was also speaking with Andrew C. Revkin, who covers the environment for the New York Times. Thank you so much for joining me this morning on The Brian Lehrer Show.
You're welcome.